The views expressed on this program are the views of the individual broadcaster and do not necessarily reflect the view of Wesleyan University or the WESU management. Hello, and welcome to Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, a progressive-minded radio show about faith and action, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters. I'm Maria Johnson. Today, a yeasty visit with best-selling historian and biographer Stephen Mansfield, a politically center-right evangelical Christian who in his latest book, Choosing Donald Trump, God, Anger, Hope, and Why Christian Conservatives Supported Him, calls out Trump's evangelical supporters on their effectively having made a deal with the devil. Sad to say, a good 90% of them don't even have the sense to regret it. An expert on religious subjects, Mansfield wrote the books The Faith of George W. Bush and The Faith of Barack Obama, plus an inquiry into the religiosity of Oprah Winfrey and a biography of Pope Benedict XVI, he delves into the causes of Trump's development into the person he is and comes up with interesting answers and also holds out some hope for the future. Back in a moment with Stephen Mansfield.
Many dogs and cats spend endless days indoors staring at the wall, living for the moment when you will come home and tell them you love them, take them out, and make a fuss over them. Dogs and cats need physical exercise and mental stimulation, things to do and think about in order to be healthy and happy. Please set time aside for them and give them a real life and real love. For more information, please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals at 757-622-PETA or helpinganimals.com. That's helpinganimals.com.
Welcome, Stephen Mansfield.
Thank you very much. Very good to be with you.
I have to say, in the interest of full disclosure, that this is a rather progressive-minded radio show. That's why it's called Reasonably Catholic. And some of your work says to me that you are an evangelical Christian, and you're not really down with the fusion approach to Christianity.
I'm fairly traditional Christian, but politically sort of center-right, so okay. I confuse people quite a bit. Who knows what people think an evangelical is these days.
Very so, good, very true.
I try to dodge all the labels and frustrate them, actually.
Good for you. I try to do the same in my own approaches. So you are calling the evangelicals on their hypocrisy, not to overstate it, I hope, in supporting Donald Trump. Talk to me. What is it? Maybe you can sum up for us what the evangelicals see in Donald Trump that is so irresistible.
Well, I think the best way to explain that question, if I'm sort of explaining where they are, the evangelicals as a whole, and yes, I'm an evangelical, but I'm not with the people I'm describing right now, mm-hmm. is that if you are a conservative evangelical, and you're sitting in 2016, you feel traumatized by the Obama years, and terrified of the possibility of the Hillary Clinton years.
Because of abortion, because of
abortion, LGBT issues, the rather strident Justice Department, filings on, for example, Hobby Lobby, the case that went all the way to the Supreme Court, even a small order of nuns who didn't want to
provide abortion. The Little Sisters of the Poor.
Exactly. And so these types of issues. And so maybe it was exaggerated. I'm certainly open to that as a historical judgment, but the fact is that's how they felt. And they didn't rally to Donald Trump in the primaries. They went with other candidates, but as the time went along, they realized this is the front runner. This is a man who can actually beat Hillary Clinton. Mm. Let's join him. So, criticism number one is that their position was not primarily principled; it was primarily transactional. Okay. We should support this person because he can beat Hillary. It doesn't matter whatever else he has done.
Because he somehow persuaded them that he is their voice.
Well, that's true, and there is, I have to say, some truth to it. If your primary issue is abortion issues, for example. Donald Trump, we don't know for certain because he hasn't had a test case while in office, but he was at least giving lip service to being pro-life.
Mm.
So this is as opposed to Hillary Clinton, who is decidedly not,
right.
Who is decidedly pro-abortion, has accepted the Margaret Sanger Award from Planned Parenthood. I mean, there couldn't be a person who, in the eyes of a conservative pro-life evangelical, was more offensive on the national political stage. So. I'm not defending them. I'm simply saying if you are hesitant about the LGBT, let's call it an agenda for the sake of this conversation, or vision or direction or movement, if you are pro-life, if perhaps your children can't get a job because of a globalist economic approach that of the Obama administration, and here's Donald Trump saying, I'm going to bring the jobs home, et cetera, it's not completely religious compromise that might cause you to support Donald Trump.
Right.
Where
right.
I really became far more than concerned, but opposed to what a lot of the leaders on the religious right was doing, was when you have the Access Hollywood video come out, Donald Trump is saying and doing the things that we all know, and religious right leaders who have been very, very down the line on sexual ethics through the years suddenly are saying on their international television shows, well, boys will be boys.
Yeah.
And those words came out of the mouth of a person, for example, who has repeatedly held the line on only sex in marriage and only heterosexual sex, and the mistreatment of women is absolutely sin and things of that nature. And here's Donald Trump describing doing horrible things, and we get kind of a boys will be boys kind of a response.
Because, if I can just sum it up in a sentence from your own book, Choosing Donald Trump, quote, it was the anger that mattered.
I completely believe that. I believe that it was later it was transactional, but primarily it was anger. I think anger defined that election perhaps more so than any other. I think Hillary Clinton was caught off guard by it. I think Donald Trump channels it masterfully. And I think that the religious right slash evangelical community is inflamed by anger far more than they want to acknowledge, because technically, as Christians, we're not supposed to be.
Yeah, right,
we're not
right.
supposed to be driven by anger, and I think they were. So I think that's an embarrassment.
And Donald Trump comes across as an angry guy, so there's some resonance there.
He comes across as a man who understands your anger and can channel it. I mean, he's almost wanting people to stick their heads out their windows and say, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. I mean,
yeah.
It's that kind of vibe out of, you know, the old network news show. And so I think that he does give the sense that he understands it. And by the way, he does a masterful job with evangelicals of saying, you know, I'm not really one of you, but you honor me by your support, and I will champion your concerns.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about the Johnson Amendment. He talks about the war on Christmas, which, you know, like I say, I am basically a centrist evangelical, and I don't know anybody who's really that concerned about the war on Christmas. By Donald Trump talking about it, he sends the signal that that he cares about evangelical concerns. Again, I know a lot of evangelical clergy. I don't know of any who are really that concerned about the Johnson Amendment, that concerned about the war on Christmas.
Define the Johnson Amendment for people who might not know.
Certainly.
No, they won't.
And that's what's odd, is that very few people really do.
Right.
The Johnson Amendment was an amendment to the IRS tax code engineered by LBJ, by Lyndon Baines Johnson, when he was running for Senate the second time from Texas. And what had happened was a lot of 501c3 nonprofit organizations in Texas were opposing his run for Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't like the fact that nonprofit organizations could be effective politically. So he proposed an amendment to the tax code that said that you cannot be politically active if you are taking tax-free donations if you're a 501c3 organization. Well, he didn't even have churches in mind. In fact, he didn't really have religion in mind. He just had nonprofit organizations that were politically active in mind, and his amendment passed, his change to the code passed. Well, the practical outpouring of that for the average evangelical church member today is that their pastor cannot get up and endorse a certain candidate.
Yeah.
Their pastor's not even supposed to take a position on certain policy issues before the House or the Senate.
Which you point out in your book, people might actually appreciate
that
pastors aren't preaching to,
exactly.
or telling them who to vote for.
No, exactly. Most of the evangelicals, most of the Christians or churchgoers of any stripe that I know don't want to go to church and have their pastor hammer politics.
Right.
They don't mind if they talk about it, you know, what they would consider to be God's view or the righteous view of abortion or gay rights or what have you. And, of course, churches will come down on a wide variety of positions on those issues.
And it's kind of amusing just having some experience of listening to priests kind of torture themselves trying to say the thing they're not allowed to say in some other way, you know.
Well, and what's odd is they actually have the freedom to speak in principle. They just can't get specific.
Right.
Which is probably what they ought to be doing anyway.
No.
I mean, you really don't want your rabbi, your priest, your pastor, you know, telling you who to vote for in a primary with 16 different candidates.
Right.
But you don't mind them saying, now let me talk to you about what scripture or our tradition or the fathers or the Torah says about the following things. That's perfectly legitimate. That's one of the reasons that you go in the first place.
Right.
But no, it's gotten, and so anyway, the point was that when Donald Trump said, I'm going to abolish, he said literally, I'm going to abolish the Johnson Amendment, which by the way, he doesn't have the power to do. He was
details.
Just a small detail, exactly. It's like me saying, I'm going to change the government of China. You know, I don't have any power to do that. So that's exactly what happened. But at least he was sending the right signals, and somebody insultingly said it was a signal only dogs could hear, meaning that people who knew the issue responded to it, and the vast majority of people didn't. But the important thing was it took the evangelical leaders with him, and they then in turn persuaded the evangelicals.
I'm curious to know, in your talking with these people, these evangelical people, whether you sense any regret about their supporting Donald Trump.
I do. And
that's good.
Yeah, it's regret to the tune of about, I would say about 10% have buyer's remorse and have now dumped Donald Trump, so to speak, which doesn't mean anything practically except that they now speak bad about him.
Yeah.
Go around talking bad, as they say in Texas.
Right.
But the other part of it is that you have to realize that really no evangelicals voted for Donald Trump thinking that he was the perfect man, the perfect Christian. So all that's happened is that within their acceptance of him, there's more negative than positive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I can hear an evangelical saying, you know, I knew he was flawed when I voted for him. I voted for him because I don't want to see babies killed, or because I, you know, don't want gays taking over the schools, or whatever their hot button issue was. Now I'm more negative on him, but I'm still glad he's president. That's sort of the way buyer's remorse as a whole exemplifies itself.
Interesting. You're listening to an interview with historian and biographer Stephen Mansfield, author most recently of Choosing Donald Trump, God, Anger, Hope, and Why Christian Conservatives Supported Him. He's also the author of 2011's possibly prescient book, Where Has Oprah Taken Us? The Religious Influence of the World's Most Famous Woman. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you in its fifth year from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. Back in a moment with more from Stephen Mansfield.
Imagine me, a dog, moving in with a human. I didn't know how it would work. Turns out, my human's pretty entertaining. For instance, every time I give my human his ball, he throws it as far as he can. And I'm like, dude, that's your ball. So I go get it. But he just throws it. Again. I gotta say, though, the more he does it, the funnier it is. I love my human.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere plans for nobody.
All right. I want to go way back to Donald Trump's childhood. It seems that he was harmed by his father's not affirming him, ever.
I think you're exactly right. You know, I speak a lot to men's groups, and I'm an advocate for a noble kind of manhood in this society, at the same time that I'm an advocate for the Me Too movement. So I'm trying to fix something that's wrong here. But my point in saying that is one of the things I tell people, tell fathers in particular, is if you don't affirm your sons, they will grow up affirming themselves, and we call that pride.
Yeah.
And I think that's beautifully and tragically exemplified in Donald Trump. His father was a man who was not very emotionally accessible. The family was...
So many fathers weren't.
Exactly. This is partially a generational thing and partially a Fred Trump thing. That was the name of his father.
Yeah.
The family was eaten up with competition. Everything was competition.
Yeah.
In fact, Donald himself will tell you that his older brother committed suicide, drank himself to death, because he couldn't handle the family's culture of competition.
Wow.
Fred Trump called Donald Killer and King. Those were his two pet names for him. And if you can't see those two terms played out in Donald Trump's life, you're missing the point.
Yeah.
They did go to church, but it was a church that was pastored a little later in Donald Trump's life. It was pastored by Norman Vincent Peale.
Yes.
And Norman Vincent Peale was a man who, and on the one hand, in the privacy of his own home and the privacy of maybe his pulpit from time to time, would be the traditional evangelical, salvation in Jesus, living for his glory.
Yeah.
But he also was one of the biggest motivational speakers of the era.
Yes.
He wrote the famous Power of Positive Thinking. And having read a lot of Norman Vincent Peale's writings for this book, I hear phrases and ideas and concepts coming from Donald Trump's mouth almost every day.
Yes,
that come from Norman Vincent Peale. So the way I like to say it is, I think there were two streams out of Norman Vincent Peale's life. Donald Trump drank more from the one, the motivational one, as opposed to the other, the transformation in Jesus one.
I mean, maybe the best example of that is the line in your book about how Norman Vincent Peale valued attitude over facts.
Absolutely. In fact, it's rather cute. I heard a recording by Norman Vincent Peale where he said attitude trumps facts. Now, he wasn't making any reference to that, but it's funny given how much that's a sort of a symptom of this administration. But yeah, that's actually a printed principle in The Power of Positive Thinking. Attitudes are more important than facts. And we see that all the time, whether we're talking about the size of inauguration crowds or we're talking about, you know, I think we're in another hassle this week about the size of the State of the Union crowd viewership and the Nielsen ratings. And Donald Trump knows he's wrong, but the bravado will trump the actual numbers. I think that's the lesson that's in his brain, and I think it comes from his father and from Norman Vincent Peale.
Hmm. It seems like the message of your book, if you were speaking to evangelicals, is let's help him, you know,
yes.
That he's been let down by the religious men and women in his life who will not call him on things and guide him. He's like a lost child. He needs direction. Is that fair to say?
I think it is fair to say. You know, the good thing about Donald Trump is he does like to be challenged. He relates to coaches. He did when he was at New York Military Academy. He opens the door to these evangelical leaders, and I'm going to be crass for a moment, but the last thing I want them to do is affix their lips to his backside. I want them to speak their truth to him, and I think he's open to that. I'm not saying he's going to walk out the next day and be the ideal Christian, but I think that he likes them and looks to them for input, and if all they're doing is being transactional, if all they're doing is saying, as was reported in a Washington Post article not too long ago, well, he gives us access that no other president's given us, and so we're going to support him as long as he does.
Yeah.
They're missing the point. I, as a Christian myself, I believe that these people have the positions they have by the grace and ordination of God, and I think they should be small p prophetic voices. I don't mean that in the sense of the Old Testament prophets.
Sure.
I simply mean they should speak their truth and speak it boldly.
Right.
I think the Pope is doing that. I think others are doing that, and I think there's no reason they can't do it. But what they've done is they've essentially, to use our crass phrase, gotten in bed with him.
Yeah.
They've joined his PR team. They've engaged in a religious rebranding. And that's why I speak in the book of prophetic distance. I'm sitting in Virginia right now, so if you are the governor of Virginia and you give me access as a religious figure, I can do you the most good by not trying to be a member of your family or your PR team or your staff, but speaking truth from a little bit of distance. I can help you if I stay objective. I can help you if I don't need anything. I don't want your money. I don't want to be on camera with you. I don't need to be given any position. I'll speak the truth as I know it, and that's the best way I can help you. And I think that some of these people really, some of these religious right leaders really compromised themselves during the campaign.
It's a loss, like a wasted opportunity, because you describe Trump as someone who, in his becoming a conscious person as a young adult, he was interested in and moved by sermons, you know. I mean, he seems like he has, it's surprising, really, a kind of interest in religion.
Exactly. I mean, the question I would ask is, who else has the kind of access these people have? Donald Trump is not hiring life coaches. He's not hiring therapists. You know what I'm saying? He's not bringing in elder brothers to, you know, pay elder brother figures, elder statesmen people. He's not a businessman in the country. He doesn't see himself as equal to. So the people who have the most influence in his life, if we're talking about moral reformation, if we're talking about character, if we're talking about his behavior as a statesman, are these religious figures whom he trusts.
Right.
And they have had, by the way, some of them, Paula White in particular,
yes.
Some of them have had profound impact on him in certain areas. But
tell who Paula White is.
I'll be happy to. Paula White is a white woman who, and the only reason I mention that is that she's a well-known television preacher, and she is the most popular preacher on black entertainment television. Mm. She's got a sort of a Pentecostal style. She's pretty. I'll mention that she's shapely only from the standpoint that this is what draws a lot of criticism of her, is that she has no problem dressing nice and getting on TV and slamming home a Pentecostal sermon in a very engaging way. Black women love her. White Pentecostals love her. And again, she's very well known on as a television preacher.
And she said to him, "Sorry,
I'm sorry."
Is she the one who said to him, "I don't want anything from you"?
Yes, and I admire that. I have to say, there was a season in Donald Trump's life where he was watching television preachers at night.
To think about.
Isn't that interesting? And again, I get some criticism from time to time when I talk about these things, but there's just no question that he, though he acts exactly the opposite publicly, he has a soft spot for religion in general, Christianity in specific. He has a soft spot for preachers. And Paula White preached a series on vision that was very much like what Donald Trump believes. It wasn't murky spiritual kind of vision themed. It was how you have to plan, how you have to sacrifice, how you have to have goals. She was being very practical. He called her, said he enjoyed it, quoted large sections of it to her, asked her to come meet he and his wife in New York. She was already doing Bible studies for the Yankees and some other people up there, and so they became good friends. What's important about her influence is not just that she sort of became chaplain to his family and company, but that when he decided to run for president, he asked her to script some listening sessions for him where she would gather prominent clergy from around the country in different groupings, and he would have time to hear them out. And this is where Donald Trump really got his education about conservative Christian or evangelical concerns. This is where he heard about the Johnson Amendment. This is where he heard about, for example, the struggles of an inner city, you know, Hispanic pastor. This is where he heard about the war on Christmas. This is, et cetera. And those listening sessions, if you're being cynical, they at least taught him the language of the religious right.
Although not Second Corinthians.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it made him, you know, the Apostle Paul.
Right.
I'm just saying that what it did was it made him familiar with the concerns of religious leaders. It also, by the way, put him in the room with mullahs and with bishops and with Russian Orthodox patriarchs and cardinals, people he would never really have crossed paths with otherwise.
Right.
They softened on him. He gained a sense of who they were and how to speak to them. And that may have genuinely been one to their cause. We'll see. And so this made a massive difference in the campaign because he sounded the right tones.
Tell the story about Lincoln's Episcopal priest.
It's very interesting. Lincoln had lost a child while he was in the White House, and he was in deep grief. He would actually close his office a day a week, sit in the dark and grieve, and the business of the nation during war was suffering. And an Episcopalian priest made an appointment with him. It was not a man he knew. He was an Episcopal priest from New York. He let him in, and there were a number of witnesses to this meeting. And the Episcopal priest came in and said, "Sir, I'm sorry you've lost your child, but this grieving you're doing is wrong. It's unhealthy for you, and don't you know that if you believe on Jesus Christ, that while your son cannot come to you, you will one day go to him?" And according to several witnesses in the room, Lincoln jumped up from his chair and said, "Sir, you mock me." And the priest said, "No, this is one of the surest doctrines of the Christian faith," you know, and began to talk to him about the resurrection. Well, before the man left his office, Lincoln hugged him and, you know, asked for copies of sermons, and that happened, and this brought Lincoln out of his, I won't be insulting to call it a funk. He was heading towards depression. You know, yeah. Lincoln suffered from manic depression. He'd almost killed himself several times in his life. His friends had to sit suicide watch. He said that all his life he was haunted by the thought of rain falling on graves. So this intervention by this Episcopal priest while Lincoln was in the White House probably saved Lincoln from sliding into serious depression, and at a time when the nation was at war.
And you tell the story in the book as a kind of object lesson for Trump, that this is what he needs.
Exactly. I mean, I think we have a, you know, people are a little suspicious, I understand, in our current society of religious figures around presidents, but many times this has done a great deal of good. Here's an example of the good done in Lincoln's life. I could tell stories later about clergy going and saying you're ignoring the poor or you're trouncing immigrants or what have you, you know. And then, of course, some of them, and I tell the story, too, of Billy Graham, who feels like he was used. So there's a very
by Nixon.
History, by Nixon, exactly. Billy Graham, people may not know that, you know, actually, Billy Graham made a number of mistakes. Some of them are rather funny to tell in his interactions with presidents, including with Truman. But later, as he became known as the man who was the friend of the preacher, who was the friend of the presidents, Nixon really reeled him in. Really called him a lot, and you know, asked his counsel, and just as they say in Texas, soft soaped him. You know, in other words, really stroked him and made him feel important. And later, Billy Graham said, "I think I got played. I think his religion was one of sentimentality. I think he pulled me in."
And it was the expletives deleted of the tapes that kind of persuaded him of that.
And the anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
You know, Nixon would talk about Israel and God's will, and you know, the Bible and Israel and what have you. And Graham was gratified by that. But then when you heard the tapes, of course, Nixon was a flaming anti-Semite.
Right. If you're just joining us, this is a visit with historian and biographer and Trump critic Stephen Mansfield, an evangelical Christian whose most recent book is Choosing Donald Trump, God, Anger, Hope, and Why Christian Conservatives Supported Him. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you in its fifth year from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. Back in a moment with more from Stephen Mansfield.
Hi, this is Bill Maher. I can find humor in almost anything, but one thing I never laugh about is cruelty to animals. If you don't get the joke either, write People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, 501 Front Street, Norfolk, Virginia, 23510. Thank you.
I have a note here. It's one of the more interesting ways that evangelicals justify their support of Trump, and it has to do with Cyrus the Great.
Yeah, there's another obscure thing that has to be explained, but it had a lot of influence on the 2016 election. There were Christian leaders who had come to believe, through a variety of influences, reading the Bible, feeling like God told them, that Trump was Cyrus the Great. And the reason that's important is that in the Old Testament, Cyrus the Great was a king who was known to be vile. He was known to be violent. He was known to be murderous. And yet, the Old Testament prophets, several of them, spoke for God and said, I'm going to use this man. I'm going to use him to do my will in the earth. The prophets even say this, and again, they're speaking for God, this man is my shepherd, which of course is exactly what the word pastor means. So it's virtually that, you know, he's my shepherd. I'm going to use him as a shepherd of my people. I'm going to put my words in his mouth. I'm going to guide him. He's going to do my will in the earth. The prophets even say his past offenses will be cleansed. And this, of course, is the Persian king who liberates the people of God from Babylonian bondage. And so this is the Persian king who returns the people of Israel, the Jews, to their land and liberates them from the Babylonian captivity. So once this perspective began to circulate, then we had a Donald Trump whom we could, it was almost as though we could wink at his foibles, at his failures, at his sins. We don't expect him to be righteous. We just need to believe that God is going to use him.
I'm so curious about how somebody, did they have to go deep into the weeds of Scripture to find this example? Who knows anything about Cyrus the Great? And yet you make it sound like it was pretty persuasive for a good number of people.
Well, in fact, the reason it was persuasive is that Cyrus the Great is sort of the exemplar of a Christian view of government and God using even unrighteous figures in the world.
Okay.
Romans 13, for example, says that there is no authority except that which God has established. And we see throughout Scripture that God is often using wicked kings, unrighteous people. Mm-hmm. He says, I'm going to use Pharaoh, you know, and then he delivers his people out of Egypt, etc. So throughout Scripture, God is capable, God does use even unrighteous figures.
Before Trump, people were versed in Cyrus the Great.
Yeah. I mean, they would have known about him. I mean, if they were well read scripturally.
Okay.
But what was more important, perhaps, than just the individual issue of Cyrus the Great, is that Christians, for the most part, believe that God can use evil. He can use even wicked people. For example, the whole book of Habakkuk in the Old Testament is a prophet saying, "Lord, what are you going to do about your wicked people?" And God says, "Hang on, I got a plan here. I'm going to use Cyrus." And then Habakkuk goes, whoa, hang on just a minute. He's more evil than your people are. Yeah, that's right, and I'm going to use him. And the conclusion is, well, the Lord's ways prevail. You know, blessed be the name of the Lord. So the whole point is, regardless of Cyrus, whether people know who he is or not, the basic Christian, it's one of the great Christian conundrums, you know, or not just Christian, Judeo-Christian, that God can use wicked people for his purposes, not so much to proclaim his truth, but to move historical forces. And so that's a standard principle of Christian theology, of Judaism. And so that was just sort of summoned in the image of Cyrus when this election came along. People who'd never even heard of Cyrus still said, hey, that's a great idea, and bought on to Donald Trump.
You know, this is going to sound a little silly, and I'm not saying Hillary Clinton is evil, but why wouldn't they say, well, God can use Hillary Clinton? You know?
Well, exactly.
She's actually more Christian than anybody who ever ran for office, perhaps, maybe excluding Jimmy Carter.
Yeah. I mean, I have made the point, much to the chagrin of my conservative friends, that Hillary Clinton's one of the most religiously outspoken politicians of our generation. And of course, since her version of faith doesn't align with a lot of folks on the right, they don't want to see that. But there's just no question that it's true. But I think the issue is that Hillary Clinton's politics were contrary to where a lot of evangelicals were, and so they were happier to take a man whom they saw to be immoral, but who was politically in their camp, and that's what won them.
Wow. Even if they grab women by the crotch, they're, you know, preferable to a woman who's, you know. Anyway, don't get me started.
Yeah. I mean, that's where I think the great compromise has come.
Yeah.
I mean, I can support a politician. In fact, I imagine I have at some point in my life vote for someone who I think is repentantly immoral. You know, I'm sure I have. I can't think of who it is right now, but I'm in my 50s, and I've been voting since I was 18, and so I'm sure at some point I've looked at some politician and said, well, he was an idiot back in the day. But I tell you what, that's a whole different thing than doing what Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council recently did and saying, well, we'll have to give Trump a mulligan because he's paying off a porn star for not disclosing whatever it is he doesn't want disclosed. That's actually the word that was used. It's a golfing term that says you get another shot.
That is unbelievable.
It's just unbelievable. And so the issue for me, though, is if I was in the position of, oh, who knows, Franklin Graham or Dr. Jeffers from First Baptist Dallas, I'd just stand up and say, this is wicked, this is immoral, this is evidence of Trump's fallen nature. I might still vote for him because in a choice between these two people, I think he's still the better candidate. But I'm going to speak boldly and firmly and clearly about the immorality of what he's done. The sadness is that Trump would probably take that beating because he himself has said that these things were wrong.
Yeah.
But these religious leaders just walk so delicately around him. They won't get up and preach the kind of sermons they would have preached 20 years ago on these subjects. They've definitely softened and definitely compromised, and I think it's going to there's going to be serious backlash from a variety of forces.
Wow.
Not the least of which is the millennials, who are deeply offended by
to
the
whom
way
you dedicate the book.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time on university campuses, and I like hanging out with the young, even though, as I say, I'm in the 50s, and I much prefer to sit with the students at the pizza joint late at night talking about things than sit with, you know, too long with the faculty. And inevitably, I think that even though millennials are called snowflakes and derided by people in corporations and so on, I think they're pretty amazing. I think they've got a pretty wonderful social conscience on the make, and I think they've got a perspective we ought to hear. And they are leaving evangelical churches in some cases. If they are evangelicals, and they are certainly offended by the way the right has played up to Donald Trump to the point of moral compromise.
Interesting. Well, this is a kind of interesting segue to our turning our attention to Oprah, because if the youth are leaving the evangelical camp like they're leaving the Catholic Church and other churches, it's probably because they're tempted by the kind of spirituality that Oprah espouses. And I can't resist mentioning that although your book, Where Has Oprah Taken Us, was published in 2011, you must have been just jumping out of your skin when recently her Golden Globe speech brought her to the forefront of our attention as a potential candidate. You must have been like, wait a minute, this is too weird.
Let me say that I like Oprah. I'm glad for what she's done when it comes to issues of abuse and bringing those kinds of issues to the fore. I'm an advocate for the Me Too movement. That's not any advocacy she has for that, I'm all for. Where I had a problem with Oprah and what the book is about is when it came to religion.
Mm.
I wish she had sort of, and this sounds pejorative and I don't mean it this way, I wish she'd sort of stayed in her lane, done the great show she was doing, been the advocate for so many important causes. But when she veered into religion, in my opinion, she got weird.
Hmm.
And she became a strong advocate for, if you'll recall the book and the video series, The Secret.
Yeah.
And The Secret, basically, is thoughts become things. Now, I certainly understand the whole idea of positive mental attitude and, you know, being careful about your thoughts for what it produces in your life. But Oprah got to be such an advocate for thoughts become things and The Secret that she said when she opened The Secret, she was opening God in the box. And she actually veered into something that I have been critical and others have been critical about faith healers because of a certain perspective, and that is that you know, you and I can't see each other, but for all you know, I'm in a wheelchair. And if I'm in a wheelchair and I'm there because of my thoughts, because of something I've done wrong,
yeah.
Well, now you've stepped into a whole different category. And that is that Oprah did speak in those terms. I'm sorry to say it. She did speak in those terms. Yeah. I would have corrected Oral Roberts if he had spoken in those terms.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly was an advocate against what Oprah was saying. And so I would just want to be clear that if Oprah runs for president, she might be have some greatness to her. She's doing a fine job on 60 Minutes.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of virtue in her. But when she veered into religion, it wasn't just that she ignored sort of traditional religion and went with kind of a new age kind of mishmash, but she actually stepped into the error of saying that those who have been raped, those who might be in wheelchairs or be handicapped, they are their condition is the result of their flawed thoughts, and that's very, very dangerous territory.
It's blaming the victim.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And my point was not to beat her up. My point was to say, hold up now. You know, religion is not just something irrational and murky that we can just say whatever we want whenever we want. There are consequences of these ideas, and someone needs to raise, you know, some concerns. I mean, one of her mentors was Eckhart Tolle, and he taught that car accidents happen because of unresolved issues in our souls.
Oh,
well, now I've had a car accident or two, and I'll tell you it had to do with somebody ignoring a stop sign.
Right.
It doesn't have to do with my anger towards my father or unforgiveness or, you know, me being mad at you or whatever. You know, I'm just having fun.
On a karmic level or
exactly,
something, right? Yeah.
Exactly. But at a practical level, you know, my children are healthy, but I'm saying if my child has whatever, is beset by autism, well, suddenly that's my fault? You see where she took things, and I don't think she's...
But would you say, just to be fair, that's not her main message?
No, it's not. But at the time I wrote the book, she had spent about 2 years, two seasons, primarily being religious. She liked the idea of being called the nation's pastor, and I'm a guy who writes about American history and religion, politics and religion, culture and religion, and so, you know, frankly, that's the most negative book I've ever written. Not negative in tone, but the most opposed to my subject, because I thought what she was doing with religion was absurd and potentially dangerous.
This is a visit with Stephen Mansfield, author of Choosing Donald Trump, God, Anger, Hope, and Why Christian Conservatives Supported Him, on Reasonably Catholic Keeping the Faith, coming to you in its fifth year from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. Back in a moment with more from Stephen Mansfield.
It's a medical breakthrough, a doctor's prescription to help prevent cancer and improve survival rates. But you don't go to the pharmacy, you go to the supermarket for fruits, vegetables, and other high-fiber vegetarian foods. Side effects may include increased energy, healthy weight loss, and lower cholesterol. For a free recipe booklet, call 866-906-WELL or visit cancerproject.org. This message brought to you by the Cancer Project, committed to preventing cancer and improving survival.
I think post-Donald Trump, all bets are off. I think anybody can run. You know, I think Oprah would do some great things in office. She probably won't run. She's saying it's not in her DNA, and I respect her for that because not everybody can be president. Not everybody should be president. People are very good in one field and shouldn't step into another. And I would hate to see her run for her own sake.
Yeah.
But I don't dislike her, and I would enjoy knowing her. I would be happy to join hands with her on 15 different fronts she's committed to. But she's been weird and potentially destructive in religion, and I had no problem writing about it because she happened to step into my academic field and my writing field. And, you know, I would, in the same way I've taken on Trump, I took her on a little bit. So,
did you hear anything from her after you published the book?
Secondhand, I did.
And
she actually, the one thing I heard was, and I hear this often, and it's I almost want to put it on my wall as my main achievement in life, that I am kind to my subjects. I'm kind to them. I'm not going to bash anyone.
I would say that's a fair assessment.
Yeah.
Having
nobody
read two
can read my book on Trump that we've just talked about and say that I just beat the tar out of him or beat the tar out of these. But I'm using the facts. I'm trying to expose something and deal with something that needs to, I think, be corrected. And that's what I did with her. So
beautiful.
But I'm happy to have lunch with all of them tomorrow.
And especially if she endorses your books.
Absolutely. I want a picture of her holding the book saying, "Read this, it was all true." No, I'm just playing. But I don't have a need to bash people. I'm not angry. I'm not vicious, but I do think we need to let the truth win out.
You know, there have been a lot of books published since Trump ran and won the presidency. How would you characterize what distinguishes your book?
I'll have to say, and I hope I'm not complimenting myself, that it's an issue of balance and tone.
Yeah.
I would like for Donald Trump to be successful on some issue, on some fronts. I don't hate the man. I don't really want the man as my best friend. I don't really want to hang out with him. But as he's other people elected him president. I did not. Now he's in office, and I'm enough of a patriot to want good things to happen through his administration. And I'm enough of a patriot to expose what I think could be destructive to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also willing as a Christian to take on Christian leaders and say, "You guys misbehaved. Don't do it again." And so I think it's balance. I'm trying to console the millennials. I'm trying to say to Trump, if he's listening, you've got some flaws here. I'm trying to say to even some of my friends who are religious leaders, you misbehaved. Own your roles before God and be courageous.
Mm.
I'm doing a number of things at once. I probably would make more money if I just yelled and screamed and threw things and went on the cable shows and, you know, men split my skull in two. But that's just not who I am.
Well, I would agree with everything that you said just then about how your writing comes across. And I might add that there's a searching quality to it, that you're really trying to understand what created this person, what made him what he is. And you're getting at so many of the questions so many of us have. What happened to this guy?
Exactly. I appreciate you saying that, because what I want is to take the reader by the hand and say, let's go look for this stuff.
Yeah.
Got to be out there somewhere. And what I don't like about a current American culture is wherever you are, religiously or politically, left or right, don't just sit in your easy chair and curse what's going on.
Yes.
Understand it. I mean, it's so easy and cheap to just hate Hillary Clinton or hate Donald Trump,
right,
or find all reporters to be demons or whatever it is you're doing in your easy chair, you know, from Nashville. I live in Nashville, so I can mention it. But don't, that's cheap. Let me take you on a journey. Let's go look for some facts. Let's see if we can unravel this a bit, and maybe you and I both can be more effective.
It's wonderful. And
thank
I say
you.
That as somebody who went to the Women's March in New York City a couple of weekends back, where, you know, there was a lot of vitriolic commentary on the signs and some kind of mean-hearted chants, little hands, little feet, all he does is tweet, tweet, tweet. I think there's room for that, but also for this more thoughtful approach which you're providing, and I'm so grateful for it, because all we're left with otherwise is thinking somebody dropped him on his head. You
yeah.
know, they're like, what the heck?
Yeah, and something produced this guy.
Yeah.
Something produced Hillary. Something produced Reagan. Something produced
right.
these people, Obama.
And you have a chapter about both Hillary and Obama, which has the same kind of questioning tone.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, I have lots of questions. I wish I could have lunch tomorrow with Hillary Clinton and understand, what were you thinking? And,
yeah.
and you know, why didn't you do a better job religiously? You were one of the most religiously astute politicians of our generation. Your campaign, even she admits, was religiously horrible. I have a lot of questions, but mainly I think we will all be better at what we do if we understand. And I
right.
want to go beyond the cable scream fests and the
exactly.
you know, the slogans, and see if we can't have some understanding here without having to send everybody back to school for a master's degree in the subject.
Well, thank you. You know, I watch Morning Joe every weekday when I'm having my coffee, and my husband and I are interested in their guests. But today it dawned on me that Joe has this kind of continually exercised tone. You know, it's
yeah.
like,
yeah.
just take a breath, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I watched that show as well, and I'll have to say it's becoming a little bit stale
yeah.
As we just continue to just beat Trump every day. Well, I'm not advocating for him. I'm just saying, let's have a more nuanced discussion. Let's
yeah.
have some more interesting stuff. Let's talk about both sides. Let's delve in a little bit. And so
right.
I think if I can get in the middle of their marriage, Mika seems to be interested in some of that sometimes.
Yes.
And Joe just wants to huff and puff and be mad. But anyway, they can schedule marital counseling with me if they want to. But the but the important thing is, yeah, let's understand a little bit more. And of course, I probably feel the way you do, that some of these shows have such an audience and such
yeah.
get such attention, man, just a little bit of drilling down into the kind of thing I drill down into in the book would be not only interesting to people,
right.
But might help us solve some of these things.
You know, what a concept.
There you go. There you go. We
but
got a whole lot of media power and very little content going on.
Well, the thing is, not to give the media a pass, but it's that the news is so cartoonish. I mean, take, for example, Donald Trump quoting Orrin Hatch the other day. Are you familiar with this?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
You know, that he told me that I'm the greatest president, the equal of Washington and Lincoln. And poor Orrin Hatch had to respond, well, actually, I said he has the potential or whatever mealy-mouthed
sure.
thing. But, I mean, it's almost like how, when there's that kind of craziness in the ether, where is the room to be insightful and thoughtful? It's too distracting.
Well, and I think what's going on is that the press, and I'm not a critic of the press for the most part. I think most of them are doing their jobs, asking the tough questions. It's what they're supposed to do. But they do have a little bit of Watergate in their nostrils right now. They do think if we'll press two or three lines of story here,
That will be the one.
Exactly. That's what they've been watching all the President's Men over and over and over, having all the President's Men dreams. And you know, if the man needs to be impeached, he needs to be impeached. No skin off my nose. I'd be sad for my country.
Yeah.
But let's not push that to the point of just becoming absurd.
Well, that's a good point.
I think that, you know, if he's misbehaved, let's know it. But that seems to have, you know, I don't mind strong language as long as it's not blasphemous. And I got tired of hearing S-hole in the course of a week. It's like I finally just muted my TV because I couldn't believe how much it was being said.
Right.
And again, I don't mind that word. I've actually been in the White House for meetings in other administrations and heard language as strong, and nobody went out and reported it, and nobody was that shocked. It was the way people who are impassioned talk. You know, unless they have some moral code that says they shouldn't speak that way.
But he said it about a whole continent of people.
No, it's unconscionable. He should never have said it.
And I'm sorry for it.
Yeah,
good
exactly.
Grief.
No question. And loving some of those African countries as I do,
you know,
and having traveled there and been there and have friends there and even friends in government there, sure, it was highly offensive. At the same time, okay, let's report it. Let's deal with it. Let's expose it. Let's embarrass him, and let's move on.
You know,
I mean, a week of that, and I was about to lose my mind.
I know. Well, speaking of moving on, we have barely 2 minutes left, and I want to end on a hopeful note. Maybe you can talk about what you see ahead, and whether you think the millennials are you know, last best hope for America.
I'm a big fan of the millennials. I think they are having they're stepping up now onto the stage of their generation's control and influence in our society. And I frankly expect good things. It's going to be further to the left than I am politically. Okay, maybe that will right itself. But I think we've got to have corrective to what's going on now. The GOP is horribly misbehaving. We saw evidence of corruption in the Democratic Party this last administration. I don't mind that a younger generation comes along and says, a pox on all your houses, let's see if we can fix this thing.
Who? Help us.
One of the things that I'll just say quickly, I am an advocate for the radical middle. And believe me, there are like five of us standing in the middle of the road. But I think we've lost American common sense. I think we've lost that middle of the road, you know, sort of Jimmy Stewart and, you know, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington kind of perspective. I'm not hard right. I'm not hard left. I'm probably center right. I'm happy to work with people who are center left. But right now the wing nuts are controlling the debate and the discussion, and I think that's destructive to the nation as a whole. So I'm hoping for a little bit more centrist, not because of cowardice or because, you know, the only thing in the middle of the road are dead skunks and yellow lines, but because that's where I think most Americans are and American greatness is.
Is there a person you might name?
Oh, gosh, it's hard to say. I think there are people in both parties who are more centrist. I think Mitt Romney was more centrist. I think Jimmy Carter was more centrist.
Yeah.
You know, I think those people could do business together.
Yeah.
And, I think there are probably a lot of people who are far more centrist than they want to let on because the funding is at the lunatic fringe these days.
Right. Well, you know, you may be the most conservative person I've ever had on the show, maybe leaving aside various priests and clergy people, but this was delightful.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. And I'm glad that we can accept today that being a relative conservative is not a brain bypass, that we can have a good time together.
I also feel, because I listened to your Choosing Donald Trump book on audio CDs, that I feel like I've known you a while.
Oh, that's kind.
So,
well, I've enjoyed this. Thank you very much.
Yeah, this is wonderful. And I look forward to your next books.
Well, I'm hoping I write. There's still a country to write about and still a nuanced politics to discuss, but it's been great to be with you.
Thank you, Stephen Mansfield.
Good to be with you. Thank you so much.
Bye. That was a chat with Stephen Mansfield, a center-right evangelical Christian whose latest book is Choosing Donald Trump, God, Anger, Hope, and Why Christian Conservatives Supported Him. Special thanks to my friend Cynthia Miner for the heads up about Mr. Mansfield and his writing. He's providing us with hope in a dark time. Until next time, I'm Maria Johnson. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned now for The Jive at 5, followed by Spilled Milk with Charlotte and Acoustic Blender with Bill Revel.